Hello everyone, herb lovers, sustainable health seekers, herbal medicine fans. Welcome back to Herbcast, our podcast from Herbal Reality. In every episode, we explore how traditional wisdom and up-to-date herbal science can meet the needs of the hour and support a sustainable and effective approach to our health. As you know, herbs have nourished human health for thousands of years, and whilst they hold so much potential to meet today's numerous health challenges, there are still so many questions to be answered. And we're delighted to have you with us today as we continue to deepen our understanding together. So get comfy, pour yourself a cup of herbal tea and let's begin. Today's episode is hosted by Marion McConaughey.
Hello and welcome to this episode of Herbcast. Today I'm going to be talking to Nava Carman about a healthy herbal pregnancy the Chinese medicine way. Nava is a traditional Chinese medicine practitioner in London who's been in practice since 1999 and is an experienced fertility, gynecological and obstetric acupuncturist and herbalist, specializing in complex autoimmune disorders such as unexplained infertility, recurrent miscarriage, complex issues in pregnancy, PCOS, endometriosis and other inflammatory conditions. Nava, really lovely to have you on today. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Problem. So Western herbal medicine and TCM approaches to health have got lots of similarities in that they're both sort of holistic approaches to health. They both make use of herbs and sometimes the same herbs and you know, use the herbs in the same way. But they've got really different ways of thinking about and explaining health and diagnosing health problems. What first inspired you to train in acupuncture and TCM or traditional Chinese medicine?
I had been ill as a teenager, and one of the things that happened is that I used to get these horrendous headaches that nothing would touch, no medicine, nothing. And my mum happened upon somebody who I now know was actually not qualified, and probably had he been, I would have been well a lot earlier. But he used to come and put a needle in my head, and these headaches would just magically go away. And it was like those needles were full of magic. And so I was not planning to do this for a profession. I was going to university, studying art history, thinking I'd do a law conversion course and be a lawyer in the art field. But the experience of not being well and the experience of Chinese medicine, I had limited though it was so astonishing. It kind of, I was going to say derailed me, but actually probably re-railed me for my life. And so I ended up training as an acupuncturist while I was doing my BA in art history. So when I was done, I could start work because I knew that wasn't where I was going to go. And then the headmistress of the college I trained at cornered me on graduation day and said, no, you've got to do herbs. And thank God she did. So I went straight in and I did my herbs while I was starting my practice and have never looked back. This is my first and only profession. Honestly, I think I'll do it to the day I drop down dead. It's endlessly fascinating. I would do it for free if I could. Most people I know think they want to retire. I think maybe I'll just take fewer patients, but no, this is absolutely my life's work.
Yeah, that's great. I feel the same way. I think a lot of people get into herbal practice or traditional medicine for similar kind of very personal reasons, which is what makes it so powerful, I think.
Indeed.
Yeah. So what do you find really useful about a TCM approach and that kind of way of looking at health?
It's changed over the years, actually. I think at first there was something very comforting in being given a language and a structure. But when I started, there really wasn't much out there about women's health, gynecology, pregnancy. There wasn't really very much that married up the very traditional Chinese medicine approach that you can find in books and texts that are hundreds of years old. And it didn't line up for me with what I was seeing in my practice. So my experience of Chinese medicine and things I love about it actually have changed because although that structure and that language is there, what I have realized is that although it is rooted in the classics, it is endlessly evolving and it allows for me to marry it up with biomedicine And to not take away from either side, either the biomedicine or the Chinese medicine, but actually to allow the biomedicine to inform and to specify and to narrow and be really clear about my diagnosis from a Chinese medicine point of view, so that my results and what I can expect from the work I do has changed over the years, because I've been able to use that ancient language and marry it up with the modern things that we now know and understand. Like, IVF wasn't there when Chinese medicine started, right? But it sure is now. So I need to understand how to apply Chinese medicine in a modern context to help my clients. And so this ability of Chinese medicine, what's fascinated me with it all these years has been its ability to grow with me and my practice and my understanding. And what started as me really learning on my clients all those years ago has evolved to me really now having a very profound understanding of the clients that come in with me on that fertility and on that pregnancy journey. And in a way, it has helped me to finish my journey with my clients before they get pregnant, because by the time they get pregnant, my job should be over. So the clients I now see in pregnancy, which is what we're here to talk about today, tend to be on the very complex end, because they have had an issue that has arisen during pregnancy that I haven't taken care of before they got pregnant. So it's pushed me again to understand and make sure my clients and my work is safe, and that I'm a diagnostician that is as superb as I can make myself in order to keep my clients safe and also to be super effective with what I do.
Mm. Yeah. I guess it means that the way that every herbalist practices is really personal to them, and is a complex interplay of everything that's gone before for them, all of the experience and knowledge that they've gained along the way. And it's always going to be slightly different for each different practitioner.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah. What drew you to the area of fertility in the first place then?
I had a client very on in my career who I really connected with. I'd treated fertility clients before, but she'd come in having very sadly lost her baby just before he was viable and had given birth, and had really come in being told that she was never going to get pregnant, and having bought her next round of IVF drugs, because that was a baby conceived with IVF. And we really, neither of us thought about fertility. We were just thinking, right, what can we do to prepare this lovely lady? What can we do mentally, emotionally, physically to get her ready, primed, to try and ensure that that doesn't happen again? And then the next thing I know, she's pregnant. And I really felt like, you know those, I talk about this, but you know how in American basketball games they have those big gloves? Those big yellow fingers. I feel like one of those came down and went, this is what you're supposed to be doing.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I really never looked back from there.
Oh, wow.
And now he's like, you know, 25, like taller than me. And yeah, amazing.
That's lovely. Yeah. Yeah, it is, I guess, about just treating the person first and foremost, and then the rest will follow. Yeah. So fertility's kind of often been linked to autoimmunity problems. How does that tie in with the TCM way of looking at things, and what are some of the approaches that you will take in that situation?
Well, reproductive immunology is my specialist area, meaning anything to do with the immune system and reproduction and how the immune system can fight against itself to stop people either getting pregnant or staying pregnant. What happens when the body sees an embryo as a foreign body rather than self? That's a huge piece of the fertility puzzle. And I do postgraduate training that's centered on an understanding of the immune system. And as I referred to earlier, you know, that ability to understand all the biomedicine, all the immune system and how it functions and translate that into my language has been game-changing. So in practice, what it looks like is understanding what the immune system, how it works. So that we have tests that we can do these days that have, even just in the last couple of years, they've changed, where you can now do a blood test where you can break down the discrete workings of every little bit of the immune system. The lymphocytes and leukocytes that you might see in a full blood count, great, but now also all the way to a Th17 cells, which are the immune cells that exist just in the gut. And you can see whether something's out of balance, and you can use Chinese medicine to push and pull the immune system back into the line it's supposed to be, and you can retest and see that you've done your job. And so looking at another piece, which might be the reproductive immunology testing itself. You can actually see where the immune system becomes out of alignment, and you can see, if needed, what drugs will help or not help, support or not support. And you can have a real sense of the road that that client has taken and all the small clues, all the way from someone who might get, for example, hives in the middle of their luteal phase, so a week before they're due on a period, and how that might connect to their inability to stay pregnant or get pregnant. These tiny little clues we pick up now, we can understand from both a biomedical and a Chinese medicine point of view and put them together to make sense. And then beyond that, beyond just the reproductive piece, I work mostly with people in their 40s now. I really like the complexity of that. And a lot of the time people are coming to me for my job as a kind of a detective. So I'm working with people who have had unexplained infertility or recurrent miscarriage, who have not got great health but don't understand why. And then I'm looking into things, what I would call the wild cards. So we're exploring things like Lyme disease, and we're exploring reactivated viruses, and we're looking at mold and mycotoxin poisoning, and we're looking at all the different strange and weird and wonderful things that the body does that I now have the tools and the language to not just to diagnose but to treat. And that in itself is a game changer for our clients, to look at the microbiome and then to use herbs. So I've got these amazing before and after microbiome things. So to give you an example, I have a client who came in for many years, unable to stay pregnant and with this green discharge, and nobody could diagnose it, right? And her microbiome had some issues, but we treated that with herbs because antibiotics had messed her up before. So we were able to see that with herbs fixing her up. And then yet still that discharge persisted. And so we were able to do tests that looked at intracellular chlamydia. And she actually had a problem that no antibiotic could get to because she'd had multiple courses. But herbs can get to that. Herbs can get right into the cells and fix up a problem that antibiotics can't fix up. And we have before and after testing for that. And no more green discharge. So this work is just riveting to me. It's endlessly interesting. And it requires me to go in and look at things in a completely different way than I would have 20 years ago.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And so when you're using these tests to look in sort of granular detail at what's going on, different markers and things like that, what do you use to decide which herbs to use in a certain situation? Are you drawing on both TCM diagnostics and ways of looking at things, or are you looking at modern research that shows, oh, this particular herb will reduce this inflammatory marker, for example? Or is it a combination of both?
It's definitely a combination of both, but there's a hierarchy to it, the way I work. So I would always start with making sure, I'd start with a preliminary TCM diagnosis, and then I do all my investigative stuff and make sure that diagnosis was either still sound or it needed tightening or it needed a rearrangement of the hierarchy of importance to the client. And then once I was sure that that is exactly where it needed to be, I'd make my formula. And then I would look at the research after that to see, right, have I picked the most optimal herbs here for the client? Most of the time, yes, but sometimes actually within a category. So let's say if I'm dealing with infection, you might choose herbs from clear fire and toxicity or clear damp and heat category. And within that, there are loads of different herbs you can choose from. So I might be drawn to one with a TCM hat on, but then the research really clearly shows that, for example, using this client, that chlamydia is particularly responsive to this one other herb in the category. So I might decide to swap that out. So it's really blending both of those to make sure I'm getting the best of all worlds. And sometimes I'm pulling in other paradigms. So if I'm treating Lyme, for example, then I might be looking at a Western herb or an Ayurvedic herb. Like, for example, ashwagandha has lots of interesting properties that are beyond stress reduction that are actually intracellular support for clients. But from a Chinese medicine, they're a qi tonic. So I have to be quite careful about how I use it because we can't strengthen the body. We call it tonify the body. We can't strengthen the qi of the body willy-nilly without strengthening the bugs in the body. Chinese medicine doesn't have the ability to differentiate. So my proportions of herbs change according to the body's needs. So if somebody lymphocytes are on the floor, they're incredibly stressed, their sex hormones are struggling. We can see that in a test that they're not doing well. But we also know they've got a raging pathogen. I might put 10% of that in as opposed to 50%. So it's a real combination of understanding diagnosis and proportion, of understanding the biomedicine, of understanding the different paradigms that I'm drawing on to get that right for the client. And everyone's different. No one's having the same stuff.
Yeah. That's really interesting because there's a sort of teaching within Western herbal medicine to not use certain adaptogens in an acute health situation, acute infection situation. And I guess that comes from this TCM perspective that you shouldn't use certain tonifying herbs in case you strengthen the pathogen. But it's interesting that you say you wouldn't just not use that herb, you would just lower the quantity that you're using so you could still use it in a low maintenance type dose.
Yeah, I'd have to have some basis for it. I'd have to be seeing markers of qi deficiency in the person having had an oral consultation with them. And then I'd have to look at their immune system and I'd have to see, okay, their CD3 or their CD57 cells are on the floor. Like they have no viral or bacterial immunity to fight a bug. So I've got to do something to give them the wherewithal to actually fight. If I just clear, then I'll put them on the floor. They won't be able to recover and they won't manage the treatment I give them. So it's all about that understanding of what that individual needs.
Mm. Sounds like you've done a lot of different training over the years and incorporated it well. You must be on a...
Actually, it's mostly self-taught.
Is it? Okay.
Yeah, because there's not that much... And I teach others because I think it's important because there isn't much out there around this, somebody's got to start it. And I don't want my brain to be the only brain out there. And particularly because I have a long waiting list and I'm not the cheapest person around, I really want what I'm doing to be accessible. So I spend as much time as I can doing this education piece, a lot of it for free for colleagues. And I think it's super important that the work I do, the research I do, the working on with my patients, seeing what does and doesn't work, has to be out there in the public domain. It's not gatekept. It's a huge passion of mine. The more people who can know this work and do this work, the better it is out there.
Yeah. And is the training in a TCM approach to this, or is it mainly focused on fertility generally?
So I do the occasional TCM training, but that tends to refine what I do, I find, these days. The thing that pushes the envelope for me is reading research papers and actually doing the scientific testing on people. So I work with a lab in Germany, which is amazing, called Armin Labs. And that does a lot of training on understanding the biomedicine of viruses and of... So for example, I'll give you... So I had a client come to me with MS, and we weren't able to tell how much of what was going on with her was MS and how much was other things. So we did a suite of appropriate testing. We found she had neuroborreliosis, but also had a number of other... viruses in there that we know are almost always combined with MS. So like Epstein-Barr virus. So learning from the labs how to read tests and how to understand the biomedicine, and then I take that and I turn it into Chinese medicine with my language and treat that. So we're in the middle of that process. I can't tell you, can't give you a nice wrapped bow story on that one, but I can say that she is doing really well, and I will be very interested at the end what's left so I can just turn to a purely TCM approach and treat the MS. My book is effectively the training I do. So I have a huge postgraduate diploma in fertility acupuncture. It's like an advanced level diploma. You've got to pass a test to get in and all of that, and pass a test to get through. But I'm just about to do another lecture on this, and it's taken me 3 years to write that lecture. So that's kind of like my book, but it's just not for the public. It's for other practitioners to do that work.
Good. And so you mentioned research there. Have you come across any really high quality research that produces an evidence base for TCM? It's really hard for research to accurately show traditional medicine techniques. You know, we have that problem with Western herbal medicine that often the research base doesn't reflect how we're practicing. But it may be different with TCM because there's such a good melding of biomedicine with TCM practice within China. Is there much research that sort of reflects that?
Yes, there's some pretty great research out there. In fact, we've just had the British Acupuncture Council research lead come and We did a lecture about all the recent research for my graduate community. I provide CPD every month, and we just had one on that. So he kind of walked us through what is available. And there's two ways to answer that question. It's very hard to do double-blind, gold-standard placebo trials in this because it requires us to take away the basis of how we work, meaning that sort of research requires you to do the same thing for everybody, and the basis of the way we work is nobody is the same. So yes, there is research out there, and yes, some of it is robust, and there are now some studies coming out that are, for example, there's a wonderful paper by a woman called Lee Helena Rubin, a colleague of mine in America, who wrote a paper on whole systems, Chinese medicine and fertility, where they were allowed to just trace the journey of clients given the personalized medicine and then looking at the outcomes compared to the population and seeing that it did in fact lead to higher number of live births, less complicated pregnancies, high number of conception points. So there are things out there, but it is not as robust as it could be from a Western point of view, although it makes sense to us from a Chinese medicine point of view. So tons of research. If you look at PubMed, I'm always staying on top of it. I have alerts. So I get a weekly alert with all the latest research I can comb through. We bring it to the community. We talk about it. We analyze it. We take the bits that make sense. We often ask authors questions about things. So we really try our best to be as evidence-based as we can be without compromising the treatment that we give. And when I say we, I mean my graduate community, people who've done the diplomas and who are working around the world.
Yeah. Good to create that sort of community where you can all learn from each other. Tell me about some of your favorite herbs that you use, both traditional Chinese herbs and any that you might have started to use from the Western herbal tradition or Ayurveda. You mentioned ashwagandha, for example, already.
Yes. All right. Well, I mean, starting from Chinese medicine point of view, one of my favorite herbs lately is a herb called huzhang. So it's Japanese knotweed, so it can be seen in parallel. But from a Chinese medicine point of view, it's a blood-breaking herb. And it has this amazing ability to, so for example, for endometriosis, that's a good example for this. Endometriosis, from a Chinese medicine point of view, has a basis of a diagnosis called blood stasis. But within that paradigm, we also understand now that endometriosis has a huge infective or infectious element to it. So we look at things like, for example, bacterial contamination theory. We have a look and we understand that quite a lot of the time, endometriosis doesn't exist in a vacuum. If we look at an Emma and Alice test, which is a uterine test, a uterine biopsy test, or if we just look at a vaginal microbiome test, there's very rarely a client that I see that doesn't have some kind of issue there. Ureaplasma, mycoplasma, Lyme in there, you know, there's all sorts of that element to it. And huzhang has this property of clearing infection as well as breaking blood. So the ability to use that in actually quite huge quantities is a game changer for things like endometriosis. And then I use things like cryptolepsis, which is one I use quite often. I'm working with someone at the moment who she had all sorts of problems with terrible adult acne and mouth ulcers and things like that. I was able to swab her mouth and look at the microbiome of her mouth and find Staphylococcus, Streptococcus, huge biofilm issues, which we've actually recently traced to her retainer, has been a big factor in keeping infection going in her mouth. But so we've made a mouthwash with a number of other things, including cryptolepsis, and we've soaked her retainer in that, and now we start to see improvement in that area. And then if we're looking at purely TCM point of view, there's a Bai Xiao, which is a peony, which is a blood tonic, which we give in enormous quantities because often constipation is a huge piece of the women's health issues. And if I'm looking at it with a little parallel, we know how estrogen works in the body is crucial. But often when we're seeing a blood test, it will come back and it will say, oh, low on estrogen. But what I've come to understand is that you need to dig a bit further. So I often do a Dutch test with those clients. And a Dutch test uses saliva and urine to really map hormones and map adrenal function, map neurotransmitter function. What we often see is that actually what is the issue is that the body isn't clearing estrogen properly. And so there's not much bioavailable for blood. But once we clear estrogen properly, it becomes bioavailable. The picture changes. But in order to properly clear estrogen, on, we call it phase three detoxification, we have to actually get the woman pooing properly. There's a bit of the gut called the estrobilome, which is solely responsible for clearing estrogen. And there's an enzyme called beta-glucuronidase in there, which if it's not working well, what happens is we call it enterohepatic recycling. It just gets recycled through the small intestine, the liver, backs everything up. And what ends up happening is you see women who are maybe moving their bowels once a day and certainly not in the emotionally satisfying way we need them to, or once every couple of days. And so we've got to get everybody's bowels moving properly in order to actually deal with estrogen properly. And one of the ways to do that is not to give a laxative, but it's actually to give massive quantities of blood tonics, which most women are deficient in blood anyway. And that will show up as scanty periods, sometimes as brain fog or fatigue, headaches, dull headaches at the top of their head, all sorts of symptoms. And so we just kill so many birds with one stone by having this one beautiful herb that we can actually just elasticate the dose of. Small doses where needed, large doses where needed, and they have this beautiful effect in the body. So to have this materia medica to choose from to tailor to the client is amazing.
And is that Peonia lactiflora?
That's it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I would use that herb as well in my practice.
It's amazing.
Bit of a crossover.
Yeah.
Great.
Hi there, Sebastian here. If you're enjoying this episode, you might like to know that there are plenty more herbal insights on our website. Come and discover more on the science, tradition, and practical use of herbs at herbalreality.com. You can check out some of our special features, such as our sustainability guide, where we've used our experience in the herbal growing industry, as well as that of international environmental organisations, to grade every herb with a red, amber, green mark to help you better understand how to use herbs in a way that ensures the collectors, farmers, and ecosystem the species are grown in are considered. We even have a whole area dedicated to detailed articles on threatened species, such as echinacea or slippery elm, as well as the social impacts of the herb trade. You can also sign up for our newsletter for plant-powered wisdom delivered straight to your inbox. Right, let's get back to today's conversation.
What sort of conditions really respond well to the sort of approach that you use, do you think? You mentioned before that you focus a lot of your practice on women in their 40s.
So if you were to be in your 30s, then I would send you to colleagues of mine who specialise in that, because women in their 30s, it's very quick to help them, really any point in their 30s. Couple of cycles, usually the job is done. Chinese medicine works incredibly effectively. But it's not as interesting to me as some of the more complex cases. So you're with me for longer when you're in your 40s, meaning I've got to find out what's wrong and then unravel that picture, which is often more complicated because it's been there, either sitting there and causing problems or sitting there undiagnosed for many years, and I've got to unravel that. So it's hugely effective still, and we do regular testing to make sure those markers are continuing to improve. But a lot of the time, that job takes me somewhere between 6 months and a year-ish to do that job because I'm working with those complicated cases. But as long as I'm seeing those markers improve, that's what I'm really interested in. It's never the case with Chinese medicine that you take it on faith. You should never be asked, in my opinion, by a practitioner to say, well, I like my practitioner and they're really trying hard, and I don't see anything happening yet, but I'm sure it's doing me good. That's never a conversation I want to have with my clients. I always want to see the health markers changing subjectively in themselves and in the testing that I do. So it's really important that the work we do is effective as well as caring.
Yeah. I think quite often people find that the things that they come to see the herbalist for aren't necessarily the first things that improve, but often an improvement will be seen. Like quite often someone will come back to me and say, oh, well, this issue that I had hasn't changed yet, but I'm feeling really, really great in this, that, and the other way. So I guess as long as you're seeing some change.
That's right. And actually, your body has this beautiful ability to forget. So it's really important, I think, in being able to take notes and check in with clients, because you can go back and you can say, right, so you came to me with these 10 things. What's still there? And out of 10, how bad is it? And I will have had that conversation to start with too. So we've got these markers of improvement. But also because of how long I've been doing this for, I'm able to say to clients, so brain fog's a huge feature of what I do, whether it's perimenopause or other things. And I know that brain fog is usually the last thing to get better. So I'm able to give a level of reassurance written right from the beginning in that test. You can expect this to get better from around the 9-month mark, because there's a that actually helps people to hang on in the tough times. And because a lot of the work I do involves Herxheimer or die-off reactions, where, you know, we're in there killing off infections or killing off viruses. And so people can feel worse before they feel better. So to be really able to be clear about that from the beginning and to tell them what that timeline and that experience looks like is hugely reassuring and holding people through quite a complex experience until they start to feel better.
Mm. So something like endometriosis, you covered that with the peony example. How long does it usually take to see a difference with that? Because I know it's a particularly challenging thing to treat.
It depends, I think, what you're looking for. So I very rarely see endometriosis on its own. There are usually cofactors in there. So for example, what I mean by that is if you just have a simple case of endometriosis, I'm going to send you to a colleague, and I would expect that to be markedly better within 3-4 cycles. And then you get into the more complex stuff. So here's where I may use a scan. I've got a sonographer I work with who's excellent. So they might tell me, yes, there's endometriosis, but there is also, for example, adenomyosis, or there's uterine scarring or adhesions there, or I've spotted someone whose periods don't sound right following a fibroid removal operation, and I'm like, then we find Asherman's in combination. Asherman's is when the uterus sticks itself together, and I've got to go in and figure out there's often infection. Actually, genital tuberculosis is associated with that sticking together. They're much further ahead in America than they are here. So we often do a biopsy and see what's going on there and analyze the tissue. So there's sort of gradations of endo there that are more or less complicated. We see people coming to us, for example, with very thin lining sometimes with a diagnosis of endometriosis and adenomyosis, which is often not what the literature shows. Literature in adenomyosis, for example, often has very thick spongy lining to be expected. But we see that people in real life don't always go along with the literature. And when I'm seeing thin lining in endometriosis, that's a far more complicating factor. We're looking at co-infections like Babesia and Bartonella that might be in there. We're looking at scarring we might have to deal with. We're looking at how the body's dealing with estrogen. So that takes its own time. But once we've figured out what the actual problem is, somewhere between 6 months and a year for these complicated cases is what I'm looking at. But again, we want to see that improvement showing up in all sorts of different ways in the meantime. So there's a spectrum when it comes to endo. The easy stuff, I've just got endometriosis and I'm in pain, that's easy for us. Or I'm bleeding heavily, that's easy for us in comparison to all the other stuff that might be there as cofactors that we want to deal with.
Yeah. And you don't necessarily know if it's going to be an easy case until you've done a bit of investigating into what's
that's
going
right.
on.
Exactly.
Yeah. So let's think about fertility a little bit. Do you work and support with women who are undergoing IVF? Can you do that alongside the IVF?
So technically, yes, one can. I don't anymore. And I don't train people. I train people not to do that. Actually, every practitioner makes their own decision, I should say, but embedded within my training is education for each practitioner. Because what happens is when we get women coming into us saying, I'm about to go for an IVF cycle, I absolutely believe in the value of the support for that cycle. And there are practitioners out there very happy to do that work. But by the time you're at that place and we don't have any time to work with you, I think there's a very limited scope to what we can do to help you. So we can emotionally support you. We can help optimize things that are happening in a cycle. But in terms of really being the factor that makes the difference, or even sometimes obviating the need for IVF or figuring out why people need IVF, that has to be done before somebody's doing IVF. And I think there's a huge consumer education piece in that, because IVF clinics aren't there to answer the question, why do I need IVF? They're there to say, how can I give you IVF and how can I get the best response for you? But the work that needs to be done is in why do I need IVF? And that's why I train people to be detectives, because I want to understand why. And that's not to say there isn't absolutely a place for IVF that's hugely important. And I do work with clients who've done their work and then I'm like, right, you're ready to conceive now and you'd like to do IVF? Fine, I'm all there. But it's been a long time since somebody has done that work with me and done an IVF cycle and not had it be successful first time, because everything we've done is optimized their health. And then they go on and the IVF is like the icing on the cake. But it takes 3 to 4 cycles to completely change the uterine environment, the hormonal environment. It takes time to change things. So to expect a practitioner to make a difference to your IVF cycle without that 3 to 4 cycles, I think is unrealistic. So I train practitioners to really educate the public about how can I really, I'm going to spend £10,000 on an IVF cycle. How can I make that really work for me? It's to spend a little bit of time and energy getting your health optimized before you get there. And of course, we're only talking about women's health here, but it behooves me to say that actually men are 50% of that equation. And the IVF process, the IVF factory is a very patriarchal factory. So they don't have many tools. If the sperm isn't good, they'll give ICSI, which is where you go in, the embryologist goes in, finds a sperm which visually has good DNA. Doesn't mean the quality is good, but visually has good DNA. They go in, they capture the sperm, they break its tail, and they put the head of that sperm inside the egg to try and make that embryo. But, you know, we don't know the epigenetic ramifications of that yet. A couple of years ago, the first boys that were made with ICSI were old enough to give sperm samples. And I think that very clear that in many of those cases, the problem that they caused their fathers to need to do IVF and ICSI was there in the child, which meant that child really needed to do IVF as its only option to make children. So we want to get behind that and we want to ask, why is the sperm like that? And we know that sperm quality has declined by 50% in the last 50 years. There's a hugely robust evidence around that. For anyone who's interested, there's a wonderful book called Countdown by an American professor called Shanna Swan, which is worth reading. Although, caveat, it's very scary. And we know the World Health Authority has lowered the bar for normality hugely. So now I look at a sperm test, if that's the only thing the man has been given, and the woman's been told, oh, his sperm's fine, it's your age, it's your eggs, get eggs younger from a younger woman. We know eggs have this beautiful ability when they're young to overcome DNA problems in older sperm. Technically, yes. But I always ask, why does the woman need the eggs? Why don't we do donor sperm instead? And the answer to that is never very good. And so I go in and I investigate and I look at the men too. I want to do a DNA fragmentation test. I want to do a seminal microbiome test. I want to do male hormone testing. I want to figure out why that sperm is suboptimal. And, you know, most of the time the sperm that I see is about 4% normal forms. That's not a lot. So the work that I can do with men also completely changes the woman's ability to conceive. And it's very interesting, after all these years, we often see a real discrepancy. It's still 99% women in my clinic and the men come in as a result of the women. And the women are very practical. They are, what do I need to do to sort myself out? What do I need to do to optimize this? And they just get on with it. But the men quite frequently have a really tough time emotionally with bad news or the fact that it might be them that has even a small responsibility. And so it's very, you know, I've had to learn to make sure that I have on my team people who are psychosexual counselors, emotional support people, because actually it's really quite difficult for the relationship and doesn't always work. Sometimes the men don't want to play ball and the women end up with egg donation because the men won't do their part. But it's not to say that that education piece should not be out there about what is possible for men to change their health, to improve the health of their children and grandchildren as a result of the work that we can do.
Mm. So will you often suggest, even if IVF isn't in the picture and the woman's trying to conceive without undergoing that, will you always suggest that it would be helpful to have the man being treated as well?
Well, I've got to tell you, after all these years, it's no longer a suggestion. If you have a look at my paperwork, it basically says, if you're And in fact, I had she's a lovely client. They've turned out to be wonderful clients. But she did not pay attention to the bit of my paperwork that says your partner needs to be there in the first session. And she's like, oh, you know, he's never going to be able to come. And I was like, okay, no problem. You have your deposit back for the, you know, that's it. Consultation is over. Like, I just won't do that work anymore because it's such a waste of everybody's time and money. I'm 6 months down the line with clients otherwise in the past. And everything's great with her and there's no pregnancy. And then finally I get the guy in. I'm like, oh, well, it's you. I should have been seeing all along, or you are, you know, and there's so much work to do there. And they've wasted 6 months of their time that they can't afford. So I just don't do it anymore. Now everybody comes in. They all come in at the same time. They are willing to do the same work. Sometimes they don't need to be my client. They're all good. I can give them the all clear and that makes my day. But a lot of the time they're both in there with me because that's the thing that gets the outcome. And similarly, I have to say over the years, and I got a lot of flack for this, but I audit everything in my practice. And after about 17 years of auditing, I could see that the people who were vegetarian and vegan were not getting the results that people who were eating meat were getting. And unless you're Jane or you're Southeast Indian and have this really amazing, robust constitution and have a real solid grounding in how to get enough protein and how to do a full amino acid profile with vegetarian or vegan food, I just don't find Western people can eat very well. And again, I'm seeing this huge difference in my responses. And so now, although I'm prepared to compromise on fish or bone broth, I don't actually treat people. Unless they're innately culturally vegetarian and vegan, I don't treat vegetarian and vegan people because I just cannot get the results. They don't have the chi. And I'm, you know, I've got colleagues who argue, well, that's just you not being a very good practitioner. And I'm down with that. If that is the case, there are people out there who will do that work and that's cool. But I am all about let's not waste the time when you're in your 40s and let's not waste your money. Let's get that result for you, which is a baby, whether it's natural or with IVF first time.
Mm. That's really interesting. And what sort, can you actually see changes in men's sperm count and viability from working with herbs?
Because we do before and after testing.
Yeah. And what sort of herbs do you use?
Oh gosh, but that's tailored to them too. So again, it depends if there's an infection, then we might use herbs like long dan sao or probably my favorite one for that. But there are specific herbs, but actually men's require often antibiotics to start. So we're finding the two most common infections I'll probably see that are impacting things are urea and mycoplasma. So I'd usually always start with a set of antibiotics and see if that clears up the problem in men. So if that clears it up, that's it, I'm done. But if not, then we're going into a full holistic treatment and where we're going from there. Yes, so we've got a wonderful pharmacist who works with our community and we give the test and they make a decision about whether antibiotics are appropriate and which ones. But we do have access to all of, you know, we've got such a vast array of tools. And so we just do what works, whatever that may be. And sometimes it doesn't mean Chinese medicine. Sometimes it means antibiotics. But a lot of the time, those men do require that Chinese medicine support too. And especially the gut while they're having those antibiotics, because the microbiome, when you have antibiotics, can often be destroyed by them. And we have herbs that just do a wonderful job at feeding microbiome. They come from all sorts of different categories, which is interesting. They can come from relieve food stagnation categories, from chi tonic categories, from blood tonic categories. And we can just use what works for that client.
Yeah. So in Western herbal medicine, quite a lot of the herbs that we use for microbiome support, for example, are culinary herbs. So the sort of herbs and spices that you might add to your food. Is that similar for TCM?
Wild ginger, dried ginger, big pieces, and ginger is anti-inflammatory too, so I love that parallel. We use a lot of dengue and astragalus, so they're a very classic qi and blood tonic put together that have this really amazing effect in feeding microbes. Dengue is, you have to come back to me on that, I can't remember it. I'm so used to thinking about it from a Chinese medicine point of view. But the two of them together have a very long historical antecedent, which is a very powerful qi and blood tonic. But we now know, of course, that from a Western point of view, it does feed that microbiome. Chicken soup's a big favorite of mine. And all the things that can go into chicken soup that are herbal that also feed the body are huge. So garlic, ginger, dates, all sorts of things that go in that just support the chi of that person. So it's often easier to get it into people when it's in a food form too. So I very much agree with that. Something that we do a lot.
That's great. Dungui is Angelica sinensis.
Angelica, there we go.
Which we use in Western herbal medicine as well. It's one of the ones we've stolen from TCM. So many, on the topic of herbs specifically, lots of the herbs that we use in women's health in Western herbal medicine have been over-harvested, and there's a bit of a kind of a problem with them being in dangers. Is that a similar situation for some of the TCM herbs that get used?
It is, but I have a very good herbal company I use that are very careful and very ethical with that. So they'll often come back to me and say, harvest hasn't been good, this isn't available, which I hugely appreciate because it means, firstly, I'm forced to be more creative, but also it means that I know that what I'm giving my clients is the best quality I can get. And actually that goes for mushrooms a lot too. So the mushrooms, for example, reishi, we would call it Lingxi, which is, again, a chi tonic. So we would see that parallel when we're thinking about food. We could have people eat it. We could have them have it powdered as a herbal formula and so on. But we're looking at ethical sourcing of things like that. So I use, again, specific companies that I know that they are careful, clever, and ethical with how they do that. And that's how I'm giving the form to my clients.
Mm, yeah, that's really important. We've nearly reached the end now. One final question. What do you think is the biggest challenge that women face with regards to kind of getting their best out of their health or achieving their best health?
Well, I'm going to say an unpopular opinion. It's probably patriarchy, because we are all too often, and the other thing I find, I run business masterminds for holistic practitioners too, and the single biggest factor in there in terms of women being successful at running a business is how much support they have at home. And so that goes across the board. So women are in charge of and responsible for so much. They are running a house, looking after themselves, working, trying to keep up a social life. There's so much demand on our time and so much expectation of caretaking both for ourselves and externally, and so little time available that there's not much downtime, there's not much recuperation time, there's not much time doing nothing. And I think that has a huge impact on women's health. And also the privilege of being able to afford good quality food impacts here. So if you're not able to afford organic food, that has its impact. And I don't know if you know about this, but there's something called the academic wheel of privilege. And I find it really useful to think about women's health from that point of view. There's all sorts of things that if you have in your upbringing and your background that advantage you, gender, sexuality, education, parenting, access to reading and library, like there's a whole spectrum of things. And I think how you've been brought up, what access you have to all of these things as being foundational, that's a huge piece. So if you've not grown up in a house where everyone cooks, you not knowing how to cook is a huge impairment to your health. Not being given proper or good health or sex education, huge impairment. And I know there's a lot of bad stuff about social media, a lot of bad stuff about screens. But as far as I'm concerned, that these days, when you look on Instagram, for example, the education that is available to us for free around women's health and bodies and around the expectations we should have of our partners and our lives, this has been a huge game changer for women. And to understand what is possible and what should be happening for us, that's enormous. So I think that that's a great equalizer. But where we come from and how much burden of stress is in our lives are huge pieces when it comes to fertility.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, what wonderful thing to finish on. Thank you so much for your time. I've really enjoyed talking to you today.
Thank you. I love being on. I think we started by a little chat, and what I said to you was how lovely it is to be able to come and talk about herbs. I don't get to do it often enough. So thank you for asking me.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Herbcast from Herbal Reality. We hope today's conversation has planted a seed of inspiration and deepened your understanding of herbal medicine, even answered a question or two. Please do subscribe to Herbcast wherever you're listening to this right now, and you'll be sure to never miss an episode. If you've enjoyed today's conversation, we'd love you to give us a 5-star rating and share it with someone who'd enjoy it too. As they say, learn something, teach something. It really helps us to reach more people and spread the good herbal world. You can also use a podcast review to share your comments and feedback about Herbcast, or perhaps make a suggestion for a future episode. It's always great to hear your views. If you can't wait till the next episode, you'll find plenty more herbal insights and all the previous Herbcast episodes on our website, and of course on social media. All the links you need are in the episode show notes. Until next time, take care, and thanks again for joining us for another episode of Herbcast from Herbal Reality. Bye for now.